The guards moved quickly.
"Hey, take it easy with him,"
Johnny cried as they grabbed up the unconscious man like a potato sack. Fezwar favored him with a withering glare. The wholeness colonel took out his anger by kicking at the drudge woman, but her instincts were well honed. She was out the door before he connected.
"I'll see you tomorrow," Fezwar told Gordon. "I think you'd better reconsider writing that letter to Corvallis in the meantime. What you did tonight wasn't wise."
Gordon looked casually through the man as if he barely merited notice. "What passes between the general and myself is of no concern to you," he told Fezwar. "Only peers have the right to exchange threats or challenges." The quote from Nathan Holmes seemed to rock Fezwar back as if he had been struck. He stared as Gordon sat down on the straw and put his arms behind his head, ignoring the former lawyer altogether. Only after Fezwar had departed, when the gloomy shed had quieted again, did Gordon get up and hurry over to Johnny. "Did the Bear Flag soldier ever speak?" Johnny shook his head.
"He never regained consciousness, Gordon."
"What about the woman? Did she say anything?" Johnny looked left and right. The other prisoners were in their corners, facing the wall as they had for weeks.
"Not a word, but she did slip me this."
Gordon took the tattered envelope. He recognized the papers as soon as he pulled them out. It was Dina's letter, the one he had received from George Powhatan's hand back on Sugarloaf Mountain. It must have been in his pants pocket when the woman took his clothes away to be cleaned. She must have kept it. No wonder Macklin and Fezwar never mentioned it. Gordon was determined the general would never get his hands on the letter. However crazy Dina and her friends were, they deserved their chance. He began tearing it up prior to eating the pieces, but Johnny reached out and stopped him.
"No, Gordon, she wrote something on the last page."
Who wrote? Gordon shifted the paper in the faint moonlight that slipped between the slats. At last he saw scrawled pencil scratchings, rude block letters that contrasted starkly under Dina's flowing script. "Is true? Are women so free, North? Are some men both good and strong? Will she die for you?" Gordon sat for a long time looking at the sad, simple words. Everywhere his ghosts followed him, in spite of his newfound resignation. What George Powhatan had said about Dina's motives still gnawed within him. The big things would not let go. He ate the letters slowly. He would not let Johnny share this particular meal, but made a penance, a sacrament of every piece. About an hour later, there was a commotion outside, a ceremony of sorts. Out across the clearing at the old Agnes General Store, a double column of Holness soldiers marched to the slow beat of muffled drums. In their midst walked a tall, blonde man. Gordon recognized him as one of the camouflaged fighters who had dumped the dying prisoner into their midst earlier that day.
"Must be Isterman,"
Johnny commented, fascinated.
"This'll teach him not to come back without reporting into G2 first thing."
Gordon noted that Johnny must have watched too many old World War II movies back at the video library in Corvallis. At the end of the line of escorts, he recognized Roger Septian. Even in the dark, he could tell that the former mountain robber was trembling, barely able to hold on to his rifle. Charles Bezoir's barrister voice sounded nervous, too, as he read the charges. Isterman stood with his back to a large tree, his face impassive. His trophy string lay across his chest like a bandolier, like a sash of grisly merit badges. Fezwar stood aside, and General Macklin stepped up to speak to the condemned man. Macklin shook hands with Isterman, kissed him on both cheeks, then moved over beside his aide to watch the conclusion. A two-earringed sergeant snapped sharp orders. The executioners knelt, raised their rifles, and fired as one. Except for Roger Septian, who fainted dead away. The tall, blonde, Holness officer now lay crumpled in a pool of blood at the foot of the tree. Gordon thought of the dying prisoner who had shared their captivity for so short a time and who had told them so much without ever opening his eyes.
"Sleep well, Californian,"
he whispered. "You've taken one more of them with you. The rest of us should only do so well." 14. That night, Gordon dreamed he was watching Benjamin Franklin play chess with a boxy iron stove.
"The problem is one of balance,"
the graying statesman scientist said to his invention, ignoring Gordon as he contemplated the chessboard.
"I've put some thought to it.
How can we set up a system which encourages individuals to strive and excel, and yet which shows some compassion to the weak and weeds out madmen and tyrants?
Flames licked behind the stove's glowing grill like dancing rows of lights. In words more seen than heard, it inquired,
"Who will take responsibility?"
Franklin moved a white knight.
"Good question," he said as he leaned back. "A very good question. Of course, we can't establish constitutional checks and balances, but those won't mean a thing unless citizens make sure the safeguards are taken seriously. The greedy and the power-hungry will always look for ways to break the rules or twist them to their advantage."
The flames flicked out, and somehow in the process a red pawn had moved.
"Ooh."
Franklin took out a handkerchief and wiped his brow.
"Would-be tyrants, that's who. They have an age-old panoply of methods, manipulating the common man, lying to him, or crushing his belief in himself. It's said that power corrupts, but actually, it's more true that power attracts the corruptible. The sane are usually attracted by other things than power. When they do act, they think of it as service, which has limits. The tyrant, though, seeks mastery, for which he is insatiable, implacable."
"Foolish children,"
the flames flickered.
"Yes,"
Franklin nodded, wiping his bifocals.
"Still, I believe that certain innovations might help. The right myths, for instance. And then, if good is willing to make sacrifices..."
He reached out, picking up his queen, hesitated for a moment, and then moved the delicate ivory piece all the way across the board, almost under the glowing hot grill. Gordon wanted to cry out a warning. The queen's position was completely exposed. Not even a pawn was nearby to protect her. His worst fears were borne out almost at once. The flames licked forth. In a blur, a red king stood on a pile of ashes where the slender white figure had been only a moment before.
"Oh, Lord, no,"
Gordon moaned. Even in the half-critical dream state, he knew what was happening and what it symbolized.
"Who will take responsibility?"
the stove asked again. Franklin did not answer. Instead, he shifted around and pushed back in his chair. It squeaked as he turned around. Over the rims of his bifocals, he looked directly at Gordon.
"You too? What do you all want from me?"
The rippling red, and Franklin smiled. He startled awake, staring until he saw Johnny Stevens crouching over him, about to touch his shoulder.
"Gordon, I think you'd better take a look. Something's the matter with the guards."
He sat up, rubbing his eyes.
"Show me."
Johnny led him over to the east wall of the shed, near the door. It took a moment to adjust to the moonlight. Then Gordon made out the two survivalist soldiers who had been assigned to watch them. One lay back against the log bench, his mouth hanging open as he stared blank-eyed up at the low, growling clouds. The other holmist still gurgled. He clawed at the ground, trying to crawl toward his rifle. In one hand he held his burnished sheath knife, glinting in the low firelight. By his knees lay a toppled ale stein, a brown stain spreading from its broken lip. Seconds after they had begun to watch, the last guard's head slumped. His struggles died away in a faint rattle. Johnny and Gordon looked at each other. As one, they rushed to test the door, but the lock was firmly in place. Johnny stretched his arm through a gap in the planks, trying to grab any part of the guard's uniform. The keys.
"Damn, he's just too far!"
Gordon began prying at the boards. The shack certainly was flimsy enough to take apart by hand, but when he pulled, the rusty nails creaked and sent the hair rising up the back of his neck.
"What do we do?" Johnny asked. "If we yank hard, all at once we might be able to crash out real fast and dash down the trail to the canoes.
Shh!"
Gordon motioned for silence. Out there in the darkness he had seen a figure move. Tentatively, nervously, a small, shabby shape scuttled toward the moonlit clearing just outside the shack where the fallen guards lay.
"It's her,"
Johnny whispered. Gordon also recognized the dark-haired drudge, the one who had written the pathetic little addendum to Dina's letter. He watched as she overcame her terror and conditioning to approach each of the guards in turn, checking for breath and life. Her whole body shook, and low moans escaped her as she sought the ring of keys under the second man's belt. To get at them, she had to push her fingers through his line of gruesome trophies, but she closed her eyes and brought them forth, thinking softly. Each second was an agony as she fumbled with the lock. Their releaser ducked back out of the way as the two men pushed outside and ran to each of the guards, stripping them of knives, ammo belts, rifles. They dragged the bodies back into the shed and closed and locked the door.
"What is your name?"
Gordon asked the crouched woman, squatting before her. Her eyes were closed as she answered.
"Heather."
"Heather, why did you help us?"
Her eyes opened. They were a startling green.
Your woman wrote..."
She made a visible effort to gather herself.
"I never ken what the old women said about the old days, but then some of the new prisoners talked about things up north, and there you was. You won't beat me too hard for reading your letter, will you?"
She cringed as Gordon put his hand out to touch the side of her face, so he withdrew it. Tenderness was too alien to her. All sorts of reassurances came to mind, but he kept to the simplest, one she would understand.
"I won't beat you at all," he told her. "Not ever."
Johnny appeared beside him.
"Only one guard down by the canoes, Gordon. I think I see a way we can get up within range. He may be a rogue, but he won't be expecting anything. We can take him."
Gordon nodded.
"We'll have to bring her with us," he said.
Johnny looked torn between compassion and practicality. He clearly considered his first duty to get Gordon away from this place.
"But they'll know who poisoned the guards. She's crucified if she stays."
Johnny blinked, then nodded, apparently glad to have the dilemma resolved so straightforwardly.
"Okay, let's go, though."
They started to rise, but Heather took Gordon's sleeve.
"I have a friend," she said,
and turned to wave into the darkness. From the shadow of the trees there stepped a slender figure in pants and shirt several sizes too large, bunched up and cinched tight by a large belt. In spite of that, the second woman's figure was unmistakable. Charles Bezoir's mistress had her blonde hair tied back, and she carried a small package. If anything, she seemed more nervous than Heather. After all, Gordon thought, she had more to lose in any escape attempt. It was a sign of her desperation that she was willing to throw herself in with two motley strangers from a nearly mythical north.
"Her name is Marcy," the older woman told him. "We wasn't sure you'd want to take us, so she brought some presents for you."
With trembling hands, Marcy untied a black oilskin.
"Here's your mail," she said.
The girl held the papers out delicately, as if afraid of defiling them with her touch. Gordon nearly laughed out loud when he saw the sheaf of almost valueless letters. He stopped short, though, when he saw what else she had. A small, ragged, black-bound volume. Gordon could only blink then, thinking of the risks she must have taken to get it.
"All right," he said, taking the packet and tying it up again. "Follow us and keep quiet. When I wave like this, stay low and wait for us."
Both women nodded solemnly. Gordon turned, intending to take point, but Johnny had already ducked ahead, leading the way down the trail to the river.
"Don't argue this time. He's right, damn it."
Freedom was wonderful beyond relief, but with it came that bitch, duty. Hating the fact that he was important once again, he crouched and followed Johnny, leading the women toward the canoes. 15. There was no choice of which way to go. Spring's thaw had begun and the rogue was already a rushing torrent. The only thing to do was head downstream and pray. Johnny still exulted over his successful kill. The sentry hadn't turned until he was within two steps and had gone down nearly silently as Johnny tackled him, ending his struggles with three quick knife thrusts. The young man from Cottage Grove was full of his own prowess as they loaded the women into the boat and set off, letting the current pull them into midstream. Gordon hadn't the heart to tell his young friend, but he had seen the guard's face before they tumbled him into the river. Poor Roger Septien had looked surprised. Hurt, hardly the image of a wholeness Superman. Gordon remembered his own first time, nearly 2 decades ago, firing at looters and arsonists while there still remained a chain of command, before the militia units dissolved into the riots they had been sent to put down. He did not recall being proud then. He had cried at night, mourning the men he killed. Still, these were different times, and a dead wholeness was a good thing, no matter how you cut it. They had left a beach littered with crippled canoes. Every moment of delay had been an agony, but they had to make sure they weren't followed too easily. Anyway, the chore gave the women something to do, and they went at it with gusto. Afterward, both Marcy and Heather seemed a bit less cowed and skittish. The women huddled down in the center of the canoe as Gordon and Johnny hefted paddles and struggled with the unfamiliar craft. The moon kept ducking in and out behind clouds as they dipped and pulled, trying to learn the proper rhythm as they went. They had not gone far before reaching the first set of riffles. In moments, the time for practice was over as they went crashing through foamy rapids, barely skimming past glistening rocky crags, often seen only at the last moment. The river was fierce, driven by snowmelt. Her roar filled the air and spray diffracted the intermittent moonlight. It was impossible to fight her, only to cajole, persuade, divert, and guide their frail vessel through hazards barely seen. At the first calm stretch, Gordon guided them into an eddy. He and Johnny rested over their paddles, looked at each other, and at the same moment burst out laughing. Marcy and Heather stared at the two men, giggling breathlessly from adrenaline and the roar of freedom in their blood and ears. Johnny whooped and slapped the water with his paddle.
"Come on, Gordon, that was fun. Let's get on with it."
Gordon caught his breath and wiped river spume out of his eyes. "Okay," he said, shaking his head, "but carefully, okay?" They stroked together and banked steeply as the current caught them again.
"Oh, shit,"
Johnny cursed.
"I thought the last one..."
His words were drowned out, but Gordon finished the thought.
"And I thought the last one was bad."
Gaps between the rocks were narrow, deadly chutes. The canoe scraped horribly through the first, then shot out, canting precipitously.
"Lean hard!"
Gordon shouted. He wasn't laughing now, but fighting to survive.
"We should have walked. We should have walked. We should have walked."
The inevitable happened sooner, though, than even he expected. Less than 3 miles downstream, a sunken tree, a hidden snag just beyond the hard rock face of a turn in the canyon wall, a streak of rolling water cloaked in darkness until it was too late for him to do more than curse and dig in his paddle to try to turn. An aluminum canoe might have survived the collision, but there were none left after years of war. The homemade wood and bark model tore with an agonized shriek, harmonized by the women's screams as they all spilled into the icy flood. The sudden chill was stunning. Gordon gulped air and grabbed at the capsized canoe with one arm. His other hand darted out and seized a grip on Heather's dark hair, barely in time to keep her from being swept away. He struggled to avoid her desperate clutching and to keep her head above water, all the while fighting for his own breath in the choppy foam. At last, he felt sand beneath his feet. It took every last effort to fight the river's pull and the sucking mud until he was able at last to haul his gasping burden out and collapse onto the mat of rotting vegetation by the steep shore. Heather coughed and sobbed next to him. He heard Johnny and Marcy spluttering not far away and knew that they had made it too. There wasn't a flicker of energy to spare for celebration, though. He lay breathing hard, unable even to move for what felt like hours. Johnny spoke at last.
"We didn't really have any gear to lose. I guess my ammo's wet, though. Your rifle gone, Gordon?"
"Yeah."
He sat up groaning, touching a thin gash where the breaking canoe had stroked his forehead. There did not seem to have been any serious injuries, though the coughing was now starting to shift over to general shivers. Marcy's borrowed clothes stuck to the blonde concubine in ways that Gordon might have found interesting had he not been so miserable.
"What do we do now?"
she asked. Gordon shrugged. "For starters, we go back in and get rid of the wreck." They stared at him. He explained. "If they don't find it, they'll probably assume we went a whole lot farther than this tonight. That could turn out to be our only advantage. Then, when that's done, we head overland."
"I've never been to California,"
Johnny suggested, and Gordon had to smile. Since they had discovered that the Holmists had another enemy, the boy had spoken of little else. The idea was tempting. South was one direction their pursuers wouldn't expect them to go. But that would mean crossing the river. And anyway, if Gordon remembered correctly, the Salmon River was a long way south of here. Even if it were practical to sneak through a couple of 100 miles of survivalist baronies, there just wasn't time. With spring here, they were needed back home worse than ever. "We'll wait up in the hills until pursuit's gone past," he said. "And we might as well try for the Coquille." Johnny, forever cheerful and willing, did not let their dim chances get him down. He shrugged.
"Let's go get the canoe, then."
He jumped into the frigid, waist-deep water. Gordon picked up a sturdy piece of driftwood to use as a gaff and followed a little more gingerly. The water wasn't any less bitterly cold the second time. His toes were starting to go numb. Together, they had almost reached the belly-up canoe when Johnny cried out and pointed.
"The mail!"
At the fringe of their eddy, a glistening oilskin packet could be seen drifting outward toward the swift center of the current.
"No!" Gordon cried. "Let it go!"
But Johnny had already leaped head first into the rushing waters. He swam hard toward the receding package, even as Gordon screamed after him, "Come back here, Johnny, you fool! It's worthless! Johnny!" He watched hopelessly as the bundle and the boy chasing it were swept around the next bend in the river. From just ahead there came the heavy, heartless growl of rapids. Cursing, Gordon dove into the freezing current and swam with all his might to catch up. His pulse pounded, and he inhaled icy water along with every desperate breath. He almost followed Johnny around the bend, but then, at the last moment, he grabbed an overhanging branch and held on tightly, just in time. Through the curtain of foam, he saw his young friend tumble after the black package into the worst cascade yet, a horrible jumbling of ebony teeth and spray.
"No,"
Gordon whispered hoarsely. He watched as Johnny and the packet were swept together over a ledge and disappeared into a sinkhole. He continued staring through the hair plastered over his eyes and the blinding, stinging droplets, but minutes passed and nothing emerged from that terrible whirlpool. At last, with his grip slipping, Gordon had to retreat. He drew himself hand over hand along the shaky branch until he reached the slow, shallow water at the river's bank. Then, mechanically, he forced his feet to carry him upstream, slogging past the wide-eyed women to the ruined bark canoe. He used a driftwood hook to draw it after him, behind the jutting point in the canyon wall, and there he pounded the little boat to pieces, smashing it into unrecognizable flinders. Sobbing, he kept striking and slashing the water long after the bits had sunk out of sight or drifted away. 16. They passed the day in the brambles and weeds under a tumble-down concrete bunker. Before the Doom War, it must have been someone's treasured survivalist hideaway, but now it was a ruin, broken, bullet-scarred, and looted. Once, in pre-war days, Gordon had read that there were places in the country riddled with hideouts like this, stockpiled by men whose hobby was thinking about the fall of society and fantasizing what they would do after it happened. There had been classes, workshops, special interest magazines, and industry catering to needs which went far beyond those of the average woodsman or camper. Some simply liked to daydream, or enjoyed a relatively harmless passion for rifles. Few were ever followers of Nathan Hone, and most were probably horrified when their fantasies at last came true. When that time finally arrived, most of the loner survivalists died in their bunkers, quite alone. Battle and the rainforest had eroded the few scraps left by waves of scavengers. Cold rain pattered over the concrete blocks as the three fugitives took turns keeping watch and sleeping. Once they heard shouts and the squish of horses' hooves in the mud. Gordon made an effort to look confident for the women's sake. He had taken care to leave as little trail as possible, but his two charges weren't even as experienced as the Willamette Army scouts. He wasn't at all sure they would be able to fool the best forest trackers who had lived since Cochise. The riders moved on, and after a while the fugitives were able to relax just a little. Gordon dozed. This time he did not dream. He was too exhausted to spare any energy for hauntings. They had to wait for the moonrise before setting out that night. There were several trails crisscrossing each other frequently, but Gordon somehow kept them going in the right direction, using the semi-permanent ice on the north sides of the trees as a guide. 3 hours after sunset, they came upon the ruins of a little village.
Ilahi,
Heather identified the place. It's been abandoned, he observed. The moonlit ghost town was eerie. From the former baron's manor to the lowliest hovel, it seemed to have been picked clean.
All the soldiers and their serfs were sent up north,
Marcy explained.
There's been a lot of villages emptied that way last few weeks.
Gordon nodded. They're fighting on three fronts. Macklin wasn't kidding when he said he would be in Corvallis by May. It's take over the Willamette or die. The countryside looked like a moonscape. There were saplings everywhere, but few tall trees. Gordon realized that this must have been one of the places where the Holnists had tried slash-and-burn agriculture. But this country was not fertile farmland, like the Willamette Valley. The experiment must have been a failure. Heather and Marcy held hands as they walked, their eyes darting fearfully. Gordon couldn't help comparing them to Dina and her proud, brave Amazons, or to happy, optimistic Abby back in Pine View. The true Dark Age would not be a happy time for women, he decided. Dina had been right about that much. Let's go look around the big house, he said. There might be some food. That sparked their interest. They ran ahead of him to the abandoned manor with its stockade and abatis surrounding a solid pre-war house. When he caught up, they were huddled over a pair of dark forms just within the gate. Gordon flinched when he saw that they were skinning and flaying two large German shepherd dogs. Their master couldn't take them on a sea voyage, he realized a little sickly. No doubt the Holnist baron of Ilahi grieved more over his treasured animals than over the slaves who would die during the mass exodus to the promised lands up north. The meat smelled pretty ripe. Gordon decided he would wait a while in hopes of something better. The women, though, weren't quite so finicky. So far, they had been lucky. At least the search seemed to have swept westward, away from the direction the fugitives were headed. Perhaps General Macklin's men had found Johnny's body by now, falsely confirming the trail toward the sea. Only time would tell how far their luck would last, though. A narrow, swift stream swept north from near abandoned Ilahi. Gordon decided it could be nothing other than the south fork of the Coquille. Of course, there were no convenient canoes lying about. The torrent looked unnavigable anyway. They would have to walk. An old road ran along the east bank in the direction they wanted to go. There was no choice but to use it, whatever the obvious dangers. Mountains crowded in just ahead, hulking against the moonlit clouds, blocking every other conceivable path. At least the going would be quicker than on the muddy trails. Or so Gordon hoped. He coaxed the stoic women, keeping them moving at a slow, steady pace. Never once did Marcy or Heather complain or balk, nor were their eyes reproachful. Gordon could not decide whether it was courage or resignation that kept them plodding on, mile after mile. For that matter, he wasn't sure why he persevered. To what point? To live in the dark world that seemed certain to come? At the rate he was accumulating ghosts, crossing over would probably feel like homecoming week anyway.
Why? Am I the only 20th century idealist left alive? Perhaps. Perhaps idealism really was the disease, the scam that Charles Bezoar had said it was.
George Powhatan had been right, too. It did you no good to fight for the big things, for civilization, for instance. All you accomplished was getting young girls and boys to believe in you, to throw their lives away in worthless gestures, accomplishing nothing.